My guest today, the very first guest of this podcast, could not have been anyone other than Jeffrey West. Jeffrey is a physicist, former president, and distinguished professor of the Santa Fe Institute. The reason he had to be my first guest is this. Jeffrey has published a book called Scale, The Universal Laws of Life, Growth, and Death in Organisms, Cities, and Businesses in 2017. As you will hear in today's conversation, and as I mentioned in the first episode, this book changed my perception of life. So it's fair to say that I wouldn't have done this podcast without having him as my first guest. And for that, I have to thank Brian Arthur for introducing me to Jeffrey. In this conversation, we talk about the power laws behind living organisms, cities, companies, and technologies. Toward the end, I also ask Jeffrey some personal questions, including questions about the Santa Fe Institute. By the end of this episode, you will know more about the power law behind the heartbeats of all mammals, the number of patent and crimes in big cities compared to small ones, innovation, the way technology scales, and more. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. So, your book is one of those rare writings that has changed my perception of life. Darwin's Origin of Species did that for me, along with Larry Lessig's Code, Brian Arthur, The Nature of Technology, Pinker, Enlightenment Now, and a few others, but yours is right up there. And indeed, your book gives me comfort in the idea that systems are robust and that the butterfly effect, to put it in a pop culture terms, is not everything. So you take us through biology, economics, physics, urban studies. You explore the power laws behind all living species, cities, companies, and other living organisms. Now, this podcast will mainly focus on scaling theory applied to innovation and law and economics. But before we dive into what I hope will be hundreds of episodes, please give us a little tour of scaling theory, describing some of your key findings in terms of sublinear and superlinear scaling laws regarding animals, cities, etc.
Yeah, sure. No, very good. Yeah, well, of course, that's a long story, and I'll try to keep it brief. But I think it's worth noting that scaling is sort of an interesting subject because it, in one way, it's sort of trivial. You know, because you're asking the question, if I have a system that's operating, functioning, what happens if I scale it up? What happens if I double its size or increase it by a factor of 10? You know, do I have basically the same phenomena if I increase things by a factor of 2? Does everything go up by a factor of 2? What is it that and what governs that in general? And what's also curious about scaling is that, you know, I consider Galileo the father of modern science, I mean, the person that sort of changed our way of thinking about things. Galileo, already at the very beginning, introduced scale because he asked a very profound question, really, and that is, why can't you have, you know, exceedingly tall trees and animals and buildings? What stops you? And he answered it by recognizing there was a scaling law, and the scaling law is perceptively simple but profound, and that is that, you know, the strength of beams or posts that hold up buildings or legs that hold up animals increases slower as you increase the weight, increases slower than the weight it has to hold up, because strengths of beams and things only scale like cross-sectional areas, and areas go like the two-thirds power of weight. And so, but it increases sublinearly, that is less than linearly. And so if the weight is, the weight is obviously going up linearly, so the weight eventually crushes the strength and you have to stop. And it's very profound because it says that there's limits to growth unless you change something. And it's sort of the source of innovation in a certain sense, because it means that if you want to have something bigger, you have to either change your design in some innovative way. So you go from, you invent suspension bridges, for example, as distinct from just having a bridge that crosses a river. You have to do something clever and suspend the bridge. But you also have to, the other thing you do is change materials. So you go from, wood to iron to steel to titanium and so on. So it's very profound, and you can take that paradigm, that simple Galilean argument, into, how you scale up a business, I mean, metaphorically at least, or a city or whatever.
And so what got you interested in this idea of scaling law, and I guess, how did you enter the field?
I was interested in these extraordinary scaling laws that had already been discovered in biology. And the most well-known one, and maybe the one that's most central, is something called Kleiber's law, which is for metabolic rate. Metabolic rate being the amount of food, roughly speaking, that an animal or an organism, doesn't have to be an animal, an organism has to process in order to, first of all, stay alive, and then to actually function. And that's called metabolic rate. And of course, that can be extrapolated, generalized to any system, indeed to companies, to cities, and so on. But it is most fundamental, because energy and resources, nothing can function without energy and resources, and I consider them as one. So what Kleiber discovered back in the 1930s was that that metabolic rate scales as the 3/4 power of the weight of the animal. He did it for animals. For the purposes of this discussion, let's just stay with mammals for the time being. And what does that mean? That means this curious law that if you double the size, this is a simplistic way of saying it, if you double the size of an organism, or you look at an organism that is twice its size, you don't need twice as much food, which is what you thought, naively you would think, because you have twice as many cells, twice as many customers, so to speak. You only need 75%. And it doesn't matter where you double. You can double from 2 grams to 4 grams, or 2 kilograms to 4 kilograms, or 2,000 kilograms to 4,000. It doesn't matter. Every time you double, it's the same. So it's an extraordinarily systematic law. But what is more extraordinary is that such a law exists for any physiological variable for animals. Physiological meaning, the length of the aorta, or how fast oxygen diffuses across some membrane, or for any life history event. And a life history event means how long does it take you to mature, how many offspring do you have, and so on. All of these, if you look at their scaling, they have a very simple relationship to the size of the system. So size turns out to be the major determinant of all of the physiological and life history properties of organisms. The universal number of biology is 4, turns out. So this was sort of a mystery, and it's even more remarkable because, we believe in natural selection, and natural selection says that, or at least our kind of naive view of it, is that everything is sort of arbitrary and capricious. It's everything is historically contingent. And that's why everything looks so different, and that's why we have this extraordinary diversity that comes from the survival of the fittest, with all kinds of frozen accidents and all kinds of weird historical events that took place in the history of each organism, not only each organism, but each component of the organism, each cell type, each genome, each organ. And so, you know, from that viewpoint, if you plotted anything versus its size, you would think that there would be just tremendous variation, because the variation would simply reflect historical contingency. Quite the opposite, completely the opposite. And so, namely, now if you talk about plotting these things, and the right way to plot them, which is what Kleiber originally did, is you plot them logarithmically, which in English simply means, instead of plotting 1, 2, 3, 4 on each axis, you plot 1, 10, 100, 1,000, you got by factors of 10. Almost anything physiological or about life history versus size, logarithmically, it's straight lines. And everything lies close to that straight lines. And that's sort of quite contrary to one's naive view of when I look out there in the biosphere, where everything looks like sort of random and so on. So in biology, it's the 1/4, 3/4. These are sublinear, as I already said, meaning they scale less than linearly, so that, just going back to metabolic rate, you need less energy per cell or per gram of tissue the bigger you are. So you're more efficient the bigger you are, and that's sublinear.
Let's move on now to the social economic life. You dedicate a couple chapters of your book to cities, looking at their infrastructures, including roads, metro stops, gas stations. Take us through the super linearity that we find.
If you plotted the length of all the roads versus the size of the city, and the size of the city being designated by its population, and you plot them logarithmically, the way I just said, for cities, they also are like straight lines, reflecting a so-called power law. And the exponent of those is, instead of 0.75, is very close to 0.85. So every time you double, instead of getting a 25% savings, which you get in biology, you get a 15% savings.
Indeed. It's not that we have more in a linear way. We have more in a super linear way, meaning that if you double the size of a city, you more than double crimes, etc. You increase them by 115%.
You know, if you compare Paris to some small town in France, that's a huge savings. So big cities are more efficient, in the same way that an elephant is more efficient than a mouse. So that was sort of confirms this sort of naive view that cities are like organisms. But the thing that one neglects there is, of course, the most important part of a city and the whole point of a city. And that is, all that infrastructure is there to support socioeconomic activity.
And this is where the dynamics become very interesting, because what you observe there, as I'm sure you're about to explain, is that you see super linear scaling, right? So it means that for one part of how cities scale, you would see some sublinear scaling. But for everything that is socioeconomics, then you do see superlinear scaling. Is that right?
If you look at socioeconomic activity in a city, you have something that you never see, or in biology, effectively never see. And that is something we call superlinear scaling, as distinct from sublinear scaling. And that means, for example, if I plot the wages, average wage, for a city versus its size, instead of getting something that's sublinear, that is, as you increase the size of the city, wages go down on a per capita basis. Quite the contrary, wages go up in the bigger the city, in a systematic way. But it turns out all socioeconomic activity does that. So whether it's wages or wealth, or ideas like the number of patents, or the bad things like crime, disease, and so on, they all go up. They all are superlinear. That is, the bigger the city, the higher the wages, the more fancy restaurants you have, the more educational institutions you have. But to the same degree, the more crime you have, the more disease you have, higher incidence of flu and COVID and so on, all by about 15%.
One could see how all the cities in the same country could eventually respond to the same power laws, right? So let's assume all the cities in France or all the cities in the United States. But what you observe in your work is that those power laws actually apply to all cities on the planet. So in a sense, it means that they scale similarly, regardless of whether they are located in the US, in Asia, in Africa, Europe, and other part of the world.
These laws about cities, about urban structure, urban organization, and urban dynamics seem to be true across the globe. That is, the data that we looked at were, for, of course, North America, but European countries, Latin America, Asia, China, Japan, and so on. And they all reflected very similar scaling laws. That is sublinear for infrastructure, physical things, superlinear for socioeconomic activity, whether it's good, bad, or ugly.
Now, if we talk about companies, economists have long been interested in the idea of scale. Famous publications include Stigler's Economies of Scale, published in 1958, Stanley's Scale Behavior in the Growth of Companies, published in 1996, Arthur's Competing Technologies, Increasing Returns and Lock-in by Historical Events, published in 85, and a couple others. Now, part of the podcast will be devoted to this literature, but getting back to your book for now, you write that companies like cities and organisms obey universal dynamics that transcend their individuality and uniqueness. So, what do we know about these dynamics?
In biology, the organisms, whatever the measure that you're using, cluster around the scaling law. Obviously each organism scale deviates a little bit from each scaling law, but they cluster around it. That's also true of cities, but the variance is much greater, and that sort of goes along with this because organisms have had, you know, as I say, everywhere from, you know, hundreds of thousands to hundreds of millions of years for this process to take place. But cities, you know, are hundreds, typically, occasionally are thousands of years. Very few cities are 1,000 years old. But so it's had less time in that sense to gravitate to the scaling law, so there's more variance. So that was actually a point in its favor that there was more variance. And companies should bear even more variance because companies have only been around for tens of years. I mean, very few companies have been around for more than 100 years. What we did learn when we started looking at companies eventually is more to do with probability and distributions, how many companies are there of a different size and so on, rather than the kind of scaling we were talking about in biology and cities, looking at dynamical metrics, like, you know, how many patents are produced, how much disease is there in a city, and so forth. You know, very little work, almost none, had been done on things like plotting income, sales, expenses, GS&A, and so on, versus the size of the company. I mean, that just simply had not been done. So we took this, when we were able to get the data, we started looking at it, and there was one technical question. How do you measure the size of a company? What is the metric you're going to use as a proxy for the size? And at the beginning, in my naivete, we used a number of employees. It turns out we eventually evolved into deciding that assets was a better metric. They all scale with one another. So it's, in a certain sense, it's a matter of, taste in a way. But we decided, I felt that assets say more about a company than simply number of employees, because that is often highly dependent on the business sector. You know, obviously, if you're a manufacturing company, the kind of number of employees is different than if you're an investment company. And assets turned out to be much better for that.
So what did you find?
What we discovered was that they scale. And what we also discovered is that except for one crucial metric, they scaled sublinearly, more like organisms than like cities, which I found most intriguing because I have to tell you that I expected them to be like cities, sort of, you know, to super linear. The bigger you are, the more you have, you know, you're sort of this image of companies getting more and more powerful and more like cities do. So I thought companies would be like cities, that you just have this completely open-ended growth. Well, you don't, it turns out. Cities, companies, relative to the market, are now like organisms. They grow quickly and then they stop.
Which brings me to talk about growth and death. Now that we have established that companies do not scale like cities, we need to question what drives companies' growth and the reasons why growth eventually stops.
On the average, almost all companies die. And so, in fact, we discovered from the data, wasn't a theoretical thing, that if you take a cohort of companies, then half of them will be dead in 10 years. So the sort of the expected lifespan of a company is of the order of a decade or so, and so on. And it turns out, though, when you deconstruct into liquidation and bankruptcies on the one hand and mergers and acquisitions on the other, it makes no difference. The mortality looks the same. Oh, let me back off with one thing. I said there was one exception to the sublinear scaling, and that exception is liability. Liability, we discovered, scales linearly with assets, which was quite surprising, almost exactly linearly. And that turns out to play an absolutely crucial role, and it distinguishes companies from cities and organisms because it's the fantastic characteristic of companies and finance that doesn't exist probably anywhere else in the universe. And that is, you borrow from the future. That is, you can finance something. And of course, you can't do that in biology. I mean, there's a teeny version of it, like squirrels putting away acorns for the future. But, you know, on the grand scale, there's nothing like being able to borrow, you know, $1 billion or being financed. I mean, it's mind-blowing. But what is surprising was that it's linear.
And so, in a sense, the fact that companies are closer to organisms than they are to cities also justify the approach that some economists have dubbed evolutionary economics or complexity economics, in which you build on a similar mindset than what you may find in biology, right?
Absolutely. But the thing that distinguishes it from biology, which, as I said, is this liability that you take on, which organisms cannot do. We cannot do as organisms. I mean, we can't. We can only do it in our socioeconomic life. We can do it, but we can't do it biologically.
Now, another thing that I found to be fascinating in Darwin's Origin of Species is that he finds that no species would ever evolve to the exclusive benefits of another species, right? Which of course is not true for companies, because companies may sometimes behave in a way that will benefit another company if only because it has been made by mistake. So there are quite a couple differences between species and companies, but that actually leads me to the role of the managers. You have recently published some papers on the subject, including the mortality of firms and scaling laws and a general theory for the growth of public companies. In the first article I just mentioned, you found that, I quote, mortality rates for publicly traded firms are approximately independent of age. You also found that firms have a probability of being acquired that is independent of their age. And as a result, you conclude, and I quote, that evolution and growth is dictated to a large extent not only by the firm's internal growth potential, but also by the economies and efficiencies that merging firms may be able to obtain. Does it mean that managers matter little? Does it mean, for example, that a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or a Elon Musk is mostly the beneficiary of positive conditions, and that if they had not existed, another manager, perhaps in a different company, would probably have ended up in a similar position?
You know, I'm a physicist. But the question you could ask there is very similar. If there hadn't been Einstein, would we have got relativity?
Yeah.
Had there not been Newton, would we get Newton's laws? Had we not had Maxwell, would we have had the unification of electricity and magnetism, and maybe the most fantastic of all predictions ever of electromagnetic waves, you know, that is, you know, what we live by almost now. I think most of us that work in it would probably say it would have happened anyway, but it might have come out slightly differently. You know, the formulation would have been different, but eventually someone would have discovered relativity. They would have unified electricity and magnetism, discovered predicted electromagnetic waves. We've had quantum mechanics and so on. It takes nothing away from the people that did it whatsoever.
Yep.
And it may be that their formulations wouldn't have been so good. It would have taken longer. It would have been more muddled. Who in the hell knows? It might have been much better. Who in the hell? We don't know, of course, obviously. These are all virtual reality. So there is a kind of inevitability. In the same way that we've had at the Center for Institute, we've asked questions about to what extent can you make history a science? So, and questions like, would the world, if George Washington had not existed, just about the United States, actually, would it have made any difference? Or had not even the revolution against the British not taken place then, in the long term, probably would look like this anyway. The only difference being that the capital of the United Kingdom would be Washington, D.C., and not London. Basically it would be the same world power structure, roughly.
And there are great TV shows about that, right? I recall one called The Man in a High Castle that builds on the idea that Hitler actually won the war. And you'd see how this may impact cities such as New York, right? Or other part of the world.
I mean, obviously, that would have, and it would have been a long period, dark period for the planet. And so, no, there are things, obviously, that make these exceptions. So it's not, there's no law. The laws are not like the laws of physics, if these are laws of history. They're sort of general trends and things, but it's an interesting question. Now it goes back to these companies. Well, obviously, if Bezos, Musk, Gates had not existed or had gone just to work for IBM, which they could well have done, we wouldn't have exactly Microsoft or Amazon and so on, and Tesla. Well, we would have electric cars, obviously. Electric cars would have happened. They wouldn't be like Tesla. They wouldn't be, and so on. So it's like it's just like those things I said, there would have been this, there would have been certainly a Microsoft, there would have been, and almost certainly an Amazon. I mean, after all, Jeff Bezos, when he founded it, was for a bloody bookstore. I mean, that's what he wanted Amazon to be. I mean, I know because I've talked personally with him. I don't know what he says now in public, but he told me.
There are videos on YouTube of him explaining that books are fungible and easy to store. They do not break. So in a sense, books were the ideal candidate indeed.
That was the ideal one, but he had no intention, as I understood it from what he told me, that it would be Amazon, which we see today. I mean, it evolved. So the role that he played is more taking advantage of a dynamic that was in place. Because I think, you know, retail and distribution via the internet and having some analog to the post office delivery, which is, you know, FedEx and UPS and then Amazon being a version of that, in a way, was inevitably going to happen. It may not have been as good, efficient, as broad, as internet. Who knows? We don't know. So, you know, my feeling is that, you know, the insight of these people was to be in the right, you know, the luck was being in the right place at the right time, you know, but, you know, to give them due credit, but to take advantage of that. I've been in the right place at the right time to take advantage of things, and I haven't. These people had the right personality, the right go-get'em, the right insight, and being able to pull things together. So we need people like that. I mean, they are extraordinary. And the first time I met Elon Musk, and he told me he was a founder of PayPal. And I said, oh, nice. And I said, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm going to produce electric cars. I'm going to make electric cars and I'm going to found a company to it. And I thought, God, this guy really is a schmuck. I mean, how's he going to make electric? The guy out of the blue going to have electric cars? And he told me he was going to call it Tesla. I thought, well, that's a joke. You know, that shows you me versus Elon Musk. Well, this is extraordinary what he's done, but it was the right place, right time, and he did it. We have to admire such people, but we also have to be careful of the cult of personality.
We talked about mergers and acquisition, and that reminds me of the fact that Elon Musk actually acquired Tesla, right? The companies existed before Elon Musk was involved, although it seems pretty clear that it was extremely unlikely that Tesla will become the company it is today. We talked about tech companies, and in a sense, this brings the subject of technology itself, right? And I guess my question is the following. What are the chances, you think, of finding a power law that would explain the growth of all technologies? And I'm asking the question because, of course, we famously have Moore's law, meaning the number of transistors on a microchip doubles about every 2 years. We also have Dennard scaling, i.e., as transistors get smaller, their power density remains constant, and the work of others such as Brian Arthur. But it seems that we lack a simple, elegant power law that explains the growth of all technologies, be it digital, biotech, etc. So, have you found any literature on the subject? And is there anything to suggest that such a power law exists for technology?
You know, I like to work with just a small number of people. And in these areas, you probably do need a big group because there are so many interesting questions and avenues to explore. And it requires a lot of data analysis, a lot of students and postdocs to do a much fuller job. You know, there's something called Wright's Law. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Are you familiar with Wright's Law? Which a man named Wright, who was an aeronautical engineer during the Second World War, it's more to do with economies of scale in that as you produce more, they cost less in a predictable way. But so in answer to your question, I don't. There isn't a general law about technology, as far as I know, except all these bits and pieces, some of which you've mentioned, Moore's law, Dennard's, this one of Wright's law, all of which relate to it. But I do think there is one. There would be one, and I've recent work that we've done is only loosely related to it, and that is a general theory that tries to think of innovation and obsolescence as a general theory. That is, not just in the context sort of we're implicitly talking about here, that is technological innovation and so on, but innovation in biology that happened, innovation in science, meaning, you know, governed by the number of papers and the number of citations they have and so on. So, you know, as using those as metrics for what is considered an innovation and so on. So this theory is loosely based on, and we didn't realize as we were developing it, Stuart Kaufman's idea of the, well, he called it the adjacent possible, namely that this idea that there is out there in some space, all these things waiting to be discovered, they're innovative. You know, the iPhone was actually already there. You needed the right combination of people or the right person. This goes to our previous conversation about individuals that recognize, there's that thing. I'm going to grab it and bring it in. But in that is the comes up this question that you raised, is there some simple law that sort of drops out of this, that even if it's not universal for all technologies, shows that what is the knob you can twist that tells you how one technology is either going to grow or how it's going to scale, you know, as distinct from another kind of technology.
That actually reminds me of a quite recent publication called Assembly Theory Explains and Quantifies Selection and Evolution. What's your take on it?
Yes, I have colleagues heavily involved. I'm a bit jaundiced about it. I'm agnostic, let me put it that way. I've not studied the papers. I've heard talks, of course, because they're colleagues, and I'm dubious about it, I have to say. I'm a bit dubious. And it's not, the papers are not very transparent.
And so transposed to technologies, that reminds me of the work of Brian Arthur in his book, The Nature of Technology, in which he makes a point that every new technology is a combination of past technologies, right? So in a sense, it means that it's not as if the iPhone was always here up for grab, but it probably became available at some point when the underlying technologies were developed enough, right? So potentially the iPhone was up there for 5 to 10 years, and then Steve Jobs arrived and grabbed the iPhone and made it a reality. But so, taking a step back from these various power laws that we've been talking about, they seem to suggest that systems are, on average, very robust. They end up where the power laws drive them, right? What room does that leave for fragility, for non-ergodicity, for the fact that historical events are sometimes not averaged away?
Yeah, this is a big question. And of course, these are not laws like Newton's laws. For example, if they were exact laws, it would say, you give me a city in the United States, I could tell you, you know, what the average wage is, how many police it has, how many AIDS cases it had last year, how many patents it produced, and so on. Now, of course, every city deviates a little bit from it because of its individuality. Obviously, none of these systems are optimal in the end, and they're not, I mean, they're always violating in some way. And the question is, how much can you violate the scaling laws? How far can you move? If you're mayor of a city And you come in and you're there for, let's suppose you're a very successful mayor, 10 years. And at the end you say, look, you know, elect me yet again, because in that time, wages went up by X amount. We produced more patents by X amount and so on. Well, yes, but your city grew by a certain amount. So without the mayor, without anything that you did, the organic forces would have increased the wages and increased these. So you have to measure success relative to the scaling. You can easily calculate how many more, how big wages should have gone up, how much crime should have decreased, and so on, whatever. You could done those calculations. That's how you should measure the mayor, and that's how you should measure, in a certain sense, the performance of a company. You only have, as a administrator, manager, 10 to 20% to play with of what's happening. A company, there's much more variance, as I said earlier, because they've only been around for short periods of time and they don't last very long. And you have much more to play with. You know, you have, I don't know what, it might be 30%, you know, you have to play with. But you don't have the whole thing. And in fact, one of the things, you know, when I'm asked to give talks at various places or consulted, I say, look, there isn't a prescription from the, you know, I wouldn't prescribe, but here's what I would say is you should understand these scaling laws, because that is what's dominant in your dynamic. I mean, it's kind of remarkable when you think about cities, think of all the politics and all the projects and all the reconstruction, and we're going to do this, we're going to build this, and that's gone into the city. Yet they fall along these scaling curves. You know, it didn't matter. They're small deviations is what that's given rise to. So when you have a big project in mind or something you're going to do, you're going to build up a new area, redevelop an area, add something, be cognizant that there are these scaling laws at work for all these metrics. And that's true of a company. So work with them, not against them. That's the first law, I would say. That's the only prescription I would give. Understand them and work with them.
You know, something that I get sometimes when I tell people about what you just explained is that if you take all the mammals, they have, on average, the same amount of heartbeats. But it is not true, obviously, for every single individual within that species, right? And so people would ask me, are you sure that every elephant will have the exact precise number of heartbeat? And I say, well, actually, no. External factors may also play a very important role, right? If you are a mouse and you get crushed by a car, you won't have the same amount of heartbeat as another mouse that may live for a longer time, obviously.
The thing to know is that that number exists, and that there, and to know what its variance is. How much, you know, how much can you move away from it?
Indeed. And actually knowing about this number is very valuable information, right? For example, you do explain in the book that as human being, we can go to a maximum of 120 years. Now, once you know that, you can make appropriate choices. So would you say that research around this question of making the right choices in a way to react to power law is where you will dedicate most of your upcoming research?
The thing I'm most interested in is in taking this work, which we've done a little bit of, is the planet as a whole. And the question of what's called, for want of a better phrase, global sustainability. That is, can we sustain this open-ended, actually super exponential growth? Is that conceivable even? And of course, the economist answer has been, well, yeah, like the, you know, they trashed Malthus, well, for good reasons, but the best reason being, of course, that it's innovation. You know, we just keep innovating ourselves, and then that goes back to the question you asked earlier, and that has kept us. But the point that's come out, the thing that's come out of the work that we've been, at least I've been involved in, is that yes, that is, but it just postpones thing. It doesn't solve the problem. It just postpones it to the next innovation or whatever.
You give a great analogy in the book. You explain that what is required is like being on a treadmill that is going faster and faster, while having to change the treadmill faster and faster. So in a sense, we have to come up with a game-changing innovation at an ever faster pace in order to keep up with the ever accelerating growth of the economic system, which keep on approaching a state of collapse faster.
And the real problem, which I did talk about in the book a little bit, but now I'm much more involved in at the global level, is the speeding up of time. That the price you pay for this marvelous process of innovation and new technology in particular is that you have to do it faster and faster. I mean, you can't imagine, if you take it at the grandest level, having an internet revolution every year. I mean, it's completely crazy.
Meanwhile, we know that if we double the size of the population, we will not only double the amount of patent we will get on a yearly basis, but we will actually increase how many patents we get by 115%, right? So it will get faster and faster. If I may finish with a couple more personal questions.
Yeah, sure.
The first one is the following. Have you experienced difficulties or challenges or great success, in fact, with scaling on a personal basis?
Only distantly related. And that is, I had an uncle who was a bus driver. And one of the things, he drove these big double-decker buses that went out into the country, actually. And in the country, they would have to go up hills. And I was on a bus, and it was going up a hill, and it was going incredibly slowly up a hill. And cars were getting frustrated behind and overtaking and so on. And later when I saw him, I said, yes, why does it go so slowly up a hill and the cars go much faster up the hill? And he said to me, yes, but you don't, I don't know if you realize the engine of the bus is, 10 times more powerful than that of the car that's going faster. And I said, that's ridiculous, I said, because the bus is going so slowly and the car is going so much faster. He said, no, the bus is so much heavier and it's got so much more weight to carry up the hill, so it has to have a much bigger engine. And that also stayed with me forever, till now.
You want, indeed, to compare the power of the engine with its weight.
Yeah, so that's the point. You have to scale it properly with respect to the thing to get it.
We talked about many different fields of science, which of course brings me to the Santa Fe Institute that you mentioned quite a few times. You run the Institute from 2005 to 2009, and you are still a very active member of the Institute to this day. Now, the question is whether or not you observed some power laws in the way the Santa Fe Institute is actually scaling, or whether you see the evolution of it as more chaotic.
So, the Institute is a place that evolved in reaction to the problems that were occurring in academia and elsewhere in society, but particularly in academia, that more and more big questions were being broken down into smaller and smaller pieces, and no one was looking at big picture stuff. I mean, that was sort of the idea. And so several of, really distinguished people, Nobel Prize winners, felt that there should be one place on the academic landscape where we have exactly the opposite. We try to think of big questions, and we bring together people in many different areas that are together and let them, work together self-selectively and work on some of these big questions as they develop. The Institute grew quite quickly at the beginning, but it was recognized quite early on that it can't be too big. This is the opposite to a scaling law. That if, you know, the propensity is when you form an institute or you form an institution, you just want to keep growing, you know, try to get as much money in as possible and grow as fast as you can with more and more people and so on. The institute has gone exactly the opposite direction. It did grow, you know, I mean, obviously from 10 people, which is the founders of about half a dozen people. But they did, what they realized is that in terms of its physicality, it should be small and the number of people on site should remain small, because once you get beyond a certain size, it starts to break, it balkanizes, it breaks up into pieces and into groups, and they don't talk to one another, because what you want is the economist to talk to the physicist, to talk to the archaeologist, et cetera, et cetera.
And as a side note, you do mention in the book that if you organize a dinner party with more than 6 guests, you tend not to have a single conversation for the entire group.
What people found empirically, and I think there's evidence to support it, once you get beyond 50, you break up. And we have had many discussions over the years. Do we want to, should we double the size, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the conclusion has always been, no, keep it roughly this size, because it's the only way you can facilitate these cross-disciplinary, transdisciplinary kinds of interactions.
Your way of recruiting is also very specific. As you do mention, the Center for Institutes is usually targeting people and inviting them to join, as opposed to publishing a call for applications and interviewing hundreds of people.
In terms of getting new faculty, as distinct from just new participants, we rely a lot on word of mouth and self-selection. Because the other thing that happens is we get people who get in touch and say, boy, I'd really like to come visit, or, you know, I've heard about it, or my colleague this suggested I get in touch. A large, I would say overwhelmingly, it's almost word of mouth. It's in that sense, in a way, is, at least that was my philosophy, is get smart people, motivated people, people who want to be there, want to do it, smart, excellent people, bring them together and let them get on with it. Don't tell them what to do.
So it's a very emergent process, not only in how you recruit people, but also in how you give them liberty and wait and see which kind of subjects will actually come up of all of those interactions.
Absolutely.
Let's imagine that I do run this podcast for a very long time. Which question should I ask all of my guests in order to better understand scaling laws, and why not discover new ones?
You know, I see scaling laws as a tool. You know, it's not a, you know, I think that we need to put much more emphasis on origins and understanding and explanation. For the future, I think we need this frameworks like this that have a certain universality to really start to come to terms with the future of the planet. I'm not worried about the planet itself. The planet will take care of itself. I'm not even worried so much about its ecology. That will take care of itself. I'm very anthropocentric. I'm worried about us.
Now, the good news is that if we are aware of those scaling laws and the tendency towards some of those issues emerging over time, we can also anticipate and get better prepared, right?
Oh, you've said it. You've said it exactly. And that's my point. Exactly. Let's really become aware of these and use them to our advantage.
Your book has been a major influence on my work and the way I see the world, as I mentioned in the introduction. So thank you very much for the writing. Thank you very much for the conversation. And on that good note, I wish you all the best. And to everyone out there, take care of yourself. And if you can, someone else too. Bye-bye.